This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Arguably the hardest thing Congress does every year? Figuring out how they are going to spend our money, which is perhaps why they mostly haven't recently. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 1st of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Two words as we begin, words that have been mostly honored in the breach the past eight or so years, federal and budget. After we avoided a shutdown on Friday, this weekend, congressional negotiators reached a $1 trillion deal to keep things going until the end of the fiscal. That is September the 30th, five very short months away. The thing is, a five-month spending plan isn't actually a budget, right? It's more catch-as-catch-can because, well, here's Marketplace's Adam Allington.
How did we get here, where funding the government through a series of stopgap budgets and near-miss shutdowns became normal? Well, in 2011, Congress set up an alternative that was so bad it would force the Democrats and Republicans to work together.
And, of course, it was so horrendous that we ended up doing it, and that's what's called the sequester.
Norm Orenstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. All told, sequestration would cut $984 billion to both discretionary and defense spending every year through fiscal 2021. So for each new budget, Congress must include those sweeping cuts, which nobody wants, or...
Or they're going to have to come up with a new overall plan that basically says, at least for the coming year, or even for a month or two, never mind.
And that's what lawmakers have done through September, to say never mind about sequester, and this whole toxic process will come up again for the fiscal 2018 budget.
It's become kind of built into the process of keeping the government open.
Ross Baker is a professor of political science at Rutgers. In addition to sequester, there are other partisan speed bumps that have gotten built into the budget process, so-called appropriations riders, for one.
Cutting off all support for Planned Parenthood. Usually the Republicans throw something in, limiting abortion rights. There are all kinds of mischievous things that are done with appropriations riders.
Republicans are calling for a plan to exempt defense spending from sequestration, a move Democrats might go along with if certain non-defense programs are exempted too. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, one new record high to meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You look at the immigration debate, and it's fundamentally a jobs debate, right? Who's going to do the jobs? Who's taking the jobs? From whom? What's the pay going to be? All of that. A good place to start to get a ground-level view of it is the construction industry right here in Los Angeles. In general, the proportion of immigrant workers is up. The proportion of people building the buildings who are in unions is mostly down. So, too, is the pay. Adjusting for inflation, construction workers in Los Angeles make $5 an hour less than they were making in the early 1970s. Natalie Kitroev has been covering that story for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about these two guys who you found for this story.
So Eddie Barra is a union carpenter. He has built a solidly middle-class life on almost three decades of union wages. He makes over $40 an hour. He owns his home. He has a pension. He plans to retire pretty soon.
Yeah.
Francisco Martinez, on the other hand, he is a non-union sheet metal worker. He makes $27.50 an hour. He can't afford to cover his family on health insurance. He lives in a rented two-bedroom apartment. He wants to move them into a home that he eventually will buy, but he has to work a lot on the side to make the kinds of wages that would support that.
Okay, so here comes the chicken and egg conversation, and it goes directly to the political discussion that we're having in this country now about immigration and labor and jobs and all of that stuff. What came first? Construction companies moving away from union labor or immigrants coming in and dissipating the force of unions in this country?
Our reporting shows that employers were pushing to lower wages a decade before immigrants started flooding the market. They wanted to shun union labor. They thought wages were too high. And so in the residential housing market, non-union shops started gaining power. That shift was made easier by the entrance of immigrants because there was a ready supply of people who would work for less. But it started before they got here, and our reporting bears out is that they were a tool that allowed that to happen. It was well underway before they got here.
Let's say that again. It was happening anyway.
It was happening anyway.
Where do we go from here then? Because it's not like unions are getting more powerful in this country. Immigration is in the crosshairs of the discussion at the moment. What happens?
The question of whether unions are getting less powerful in this country is an interesting one. In some sectors are making gains. In the media sector, actually, they're making gains. Overall, the trend, of course, is against them. Where we go from here is actually a question for President Trump. If the immigration debate continues the way it is, and if we continue to restrict immigration to this country, what's happening to labor markets is they're getting tighter. That pushes up wages in and of itself. Construction employers have been complaining for a while that they can't find enough good people.
Right.
They haven't, as an entire industry, raised wages much faster than average, but that may change.
How much of what's going on in this story and then anecdotally in construction and by extension in this economy is because of that thing you hear all the time, which is, oh, man, these jobs are here, but Americans don't want them? Well, you know, and the thing that you know, Americans are picky about the jobs they take.
What I will say that the reporting on this story showed is that the job itself changed over time. Someone who was working in construction in the 70s earned more than they do today. So to say that Americans don't want the job because for some reason it's hard or it's dirty manual labor is to ignore the question of wages. Perhaps the union folks will say, people don't want this job anymore because it's not as good as it used to be.
Natalie Kitcheroff, she covers the economy at the Los Angeles Times. Thanks a lot for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Media buzz today is Fox News. This morning, Fox News co-president Bill Shine followed Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly out the door of that network. There is, though, another media story worthy of a note, a partnership between Bloomberg Media and Twitter, a 24/7 breaking news stream provided by Bloomberg exclusively to the social network. It's a bit odd on the face of it, I'll grant you that. Bloomberg News is not exactly a household brand. Twitter doesn't have the same cachet, shall we say, as Facebook or Snapchat. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
Twitter wants live, original content to attract more users and ad dollars. Bloomberg wants to get a younger audience and get a foothold on the social media market. Michael Pachter is a research analyst at Wedbush Securities. He's confused about Twitter's approach.
I actually think Twitter is just chasing, you know, its tail, tilting at windmills by going after original content, because that's not the purpose of Twitter.
He says Twitter is where people explore what they already care about, not where they discover new things. But Bloomberg is just one partnership Twitter will announce today in sports, entertainment, and news. It's had success with live content, like NFL football games it streamed last year, which helped it gain users and revenue. But that was something people already wanted. The selling point for the Bloomberg deal is that it'll be something special and exclusive.
Twitter is trying to show there's a reason for non-users to come there because they'll see something on Twitter that they wouldn't otherwise be able to see.
But he's not convinced Bloomberg's content is visually compelling, nor that Bloomberg's existing audience will go to Twitter to see it. Bloomberg will own the content and likely foot the bill to create it. Justin Smith is CEO of Bloomberg Media Group. He sees opportunity in being the first major news operation to break live video news on Twitter.
One goes to Twitter for breaking news, but up until now, the primary experience for Twitter for breaking news on Twitter has been text-based. It's been tweets.
Bloomberg will provide Twitter with live video, and in return, it'll get a more grassroots take on the news from Twitter users. It's unclear how ad revenue will be split between the two. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Crude oil lost about 1% or so. Today, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate closed at $48.84 a barrel. That's plus or minus where it's been for a good long while now, which is forcing energy companies selling power from other sources to have a good long look at their bottom lines. Exhibit A, nuclear plants. Specifically for us today, plants built decades ago on the Great Lakes. Plenty of fresh water to use in cooling the reactors, lots of jobs for towns on the lakeshores, and taxes to feed the coffers. Now, though, economic history is unwinding itself, as Michigan Radio's Rebecca Thiel reports.
I meet Mike Neese at a marina in South Haven, Michigan. Palisades Nuclear Power Plant sits about 5 miles down the beach. It's expected to close next year. Neese worked there for a short time in the 80s.
It's just a very sad thing, and I think it's not only going to affect us economically, but socially the town will change as well, since it's going to be pretty much summer homeowners and summer rentals, and we're going to miss that neighborhood and that community feel.
But other residents, like Rosemary Thurber, are happy to see the plant go. Palisades is one of the oldest nuclear power plants in the country and has had several emergency shutdowns.
If we had an accident, a really bad accident, we would lose our tourist industry. We would lose our orchards, our agriculture, our wineries, just everything that I like about this part of the world.
Several nuclear plants are shutting down nationwide thanks to changes in the energy sector. Gene Grichek is with the American Nuclear Society, a group made up of workers in the nuclear industry. He says natural gas prices are at rock bottom right now.
They've just reduced the price of electricity to the point that the operators of nuclear power plants find it very difficult to compete.
And nuclear doesn't receive as many tax credits for energy production as wind and solar. Closing nuclear power plants can devastate a small town. And not just because people will be out of work.
We're talking about some highly skilled, intelligent people. And it's disappointing to think that we'll lose some of those people.
That's Van Buren County Administrator Doug Coltra. He says Palisades employees are often community leaders. They're soccer coaches and school board members.
Gracie, you'll be turned into me by when?
When's the Friday?
This middle school math class, like the rest of covert schools, gets about half its funding from taxes on Palisades Nuclear Plant, $4 million a year. Most of covert students are low income. Many are minorities. But for 3 years in a row, the district has outperformed similar schools. Superintendent Bobby Moorhead says those dollars make a difference.
Our children, they definitely beat the odds every day.
Most school districts in Michigan set aside 5% of the money left over at the end of a budget year as kind of a rainy day fund. Covert is setting aside 65% in anticipation of the plant closing. The memory of Palisades will continue on long after it closes. Its owner, Louisiana-based Entergy Corporation, will have to tear down the buildings and clean up any contamination at the site. That could take up to 60 years. And the radioactive waste will stay on until the federal government finds a permanent storage site for spent nuclear fuel. Val Gent is the senior communications specialist for Palisades. She says the waste will be safe in 20-foot-tall canisters.
The casts are steel and concrete, weigh thousands of pounds, and can withstand natural disasters.
But residents like Neese aren't as confident.
I'm sure it's as safe as they can possibly make it, but to know that it's sitting there on the beach is not a comforting thing.
The local utility still has to end its agreement with Entergy. If that isn't approved by the State Public Service Commission, the company says it will reevaluate its plans. I'm Rebecca Thiel for Marketplace.
coming up.
I'm feeling lonely.
I'm sorry to hear that. You can always talk to me.
Need a therapist? There's an app for that. Kinda. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 27 points on this first day of May, a 10th percent, 20,913. NASDAQ up 43.7 tenths percent, 6,091. The S&P 500 up 4 points, about a 10th percent, 23.88. We told you about Twitter and Bloomberg. Twitter up 6 and 4 tenths percent on that news. Third straight day of gains by the Bay after strong earnings last week. Google parent Alphabet gained nearly 9 tenths percent. Facebook added 1.5% today. 21st Century Fox fell nearly 0.5% after the news that Fox News has lost another top executive to its sexual harassment scandal. Fox, by the way, an investment firm Blackstone, are reportedly preparing a bid for Tribune Media and its local television stations. Tribune tacked on about 6% today. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Ruzdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
On our podcast, Make Me Smart, we ask our guests this.
What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
If you play by the rules, you win.
Hard lessons from Elevest CEO Sally Krawchuk. Stunning realizations, though, from TV legend Norman Lear.
I wouldn't have said that I was capable of murder.
Trust me, you got to hear that story.
Yeah. And of course, a really important lesson about livestock from the CEO of Reddit.
I thought that a pony was a baby horse.
Turns out it's not. It's just a small horse. Come join the conversation at marketplace.org/makemesmart.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Infrastructure is a word much in the news right now. The White House has been talking about building new bridges and roads and transit systems and fixing up the old ones. Not so often mentioned, all of our old buildings. That idea is the subject of today's conversation from the corner office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
The National Trust for Historic Preservation is a private nonprofit that's all about saving those buildings and spaces. Its CEO, Stephanie Meeks, has a new book out about preservation and, indirectly, economic renewal. But when we sat down a couple of weeks ago in her office in Washington, D.C., I started by asking her about the past.
This is a country which has traditionally not spent a whole lot of time looking back. And it's always forward and new and better and bigger and more. And I want. On your best days, are you making progress in that? Or is it two steps forward, one step back? Which I guess is progress too, but you know what I mean.
I think we're making a lot of progress, actually. And I'll tell you, just in the 7 years that I've been in this job, 7 years ago, we were out making the case that preservation is good business. And crickets. Today, we're working arm in arm with the Urban Land Institute, with mayors, with developers across the country who see that as millennials and empty nesters move back into cities, they're flocking to neighborhoods with historic buildings. People want more authenticity in their lives, in what they wear, in what they eat, and in the kind of places they live. And that's the kind of authenticity that historic buildings can bring to a city.
Which I totally get. But those millennials and the empty nesters, they want the cool old buildings with exposed brick and neatly redone beams, but up-to-date appliances and all of that stuff. And none of that is cheap. And a lot of urban renters can't get there from here. How do you take care of those folks?
There are cities who are figuring out a way to do this. There's a great story in Macon, Georgia, a neighborhood called the Bells Hill neighborhood, and it's right next to Mercer University. Mm-hmm.
over the course of several years, they've invested in improving 500 homes, and they've done it without displacing any of the current residents. At the same time, the property taxes in the area have increased by $1 million a year. And they've done that by mostly by building on vacant lots, but they've also worked with the city to apply property tax freezes for some low-income homeowners. And they've also recruited low-income homeowners into the area to ensure that the neighborhood continues to have that balance that everybody wanted to see.
Seems to me you can't do it by yourself, right? It can't just be a nonprofit thing. You have to get that, and this is a trite old phrase, you have to get that public-private partnership, right? Because you need the tax freezes, but you also need private developers and investment.
That's absolutely right. These are policy solutions, and it takes progressive public policy in order to make sure that our cities continue to work for everyone.
So when you think about economic progress coming out of historic preservation, is all progress the same progress? I mean, is economic development, or do you want it to be small business? Do you want it to be locals, or do you just want the dollars?
What we see over time is that historic buildings are great incubators for small business, for women and minority-owned businesses. They play a really important role. But at the end of the day, Kai, we want to see historic buildings in active use to their communities. We're not about casting things in amber and turning everything into a museum. We understand that historic buildings need to evolve over time and meet the needs of their community. And that may mean a small business, or it might mean a chain business.
What happens in a city or a town or anywhere if you don't get it right, if you preserve something that shouldn't have been preserved, or that economic development doesn't happen?
Well, the thing about preservation is that if you're not successful, there's no going back. Something gets torn down, it's gone. And that's why we advocate that demolition should always be the option of last resort. There are cities in Europe, for example, where you can see how buildings have just evolved over time. And that's a lesson that I think that American cities need to learn as well. How can we build on the infrastructure that we already have? We recycle cans and newspapers. We need to be thinking about how we recycle our buildings as well.
Stephanie Meeks, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We talked for a while, Stephanie Meeks and I did, about how the trust decides whose history to preserve. A very good question. Also, some of the specific projects they're working on all around this country. Take a listen on our Corner Office podcast. Smartphones, as we know, do a great many things that have nothing to do with actually being phones. Texting, mapping, I could go on. Also, though, helping us keep track of our health. How many steps or miles we've gone, how many calories we've consumed, indicators of how our bodies are doing. But what about our minds and those phones as mental health devices? Youth Radio's Ajani Torres-Cedillo has that one.
The American Psychiatric Association has an annual pitch-off for big ideas. And this year, organizers are expecting to hear a lot about one kind of innovation, artificial intelligence. Already, psychologists and techies are teaming up to experiment with AI as a tool for mental health.
Design of Visa was meant to be something that a person can reach out to very comfortably, so it can do empathetic listening.
Shubhankar Sarda is lead developer of Visa, a free app billed as your happiness buddy. It's designed to detect how a user is feeling.
And also deliver some exercises or cognitive behavioral therapy techniques that can help you change the way you're feeling.
Visa users skew young, like under 25. But I wanted to hear from an actual human psychologist, Esme Schaller, from the University of California, San Francisco. Schaller fired up Visa on her smartphone, and a little artificially intelligent cartoon penguin popped up on the screen. She typed in something she hears a lot from her teen clients.
My mom's a word I can't say on the radio.
Schaller is writing the B word in the text field.
And she replied, "I'll try to help." And now I'm seeing a little gif of a man rolling his shoulders. So it's not remotely related to my relationship with my mom. So I'm writing, "What about my mom?"
The app can't necessarily pick up on subtle language either, which can be incredibly important in a therapeutic relationship.
I had a client who one time called me and just said, "I love you, Esme." And that was all that she said on the phone. And I knew, because I knew that client, that she was going to make a suicide attempt. And I was able to prevent that from happening. But a bot would just be like, "I love you too."
Schaller says she does see how an app like Wyza can build healthy habits between therapy sessions. And a lot of kids, like my friend Donnie Harper, who's 17, can totally imagine talking to their phones the way they would talk to a counselor.
Yeah, I would consider it if I'm like really, really depressed or I need to talk about it right then and there and none of my friends are available to talk.
Kids my age will definitely want to know our emotional data is private before we bare our souls to an app. But my friend Savannah Mueller, who's also 17, isn't weirded out by the idea.
It's helpful because some families can't financially afford to go seek out a good therapist in person. So having a phone that you can access is probably really beneficial for them.
So could this be where we're headed? I'm feeling lonely.
I'm sorry to hear that. You can always talk to me, Ajani.
Can we always talk to Siri? Stanford researchers tested four different digital assistants. That's the general term for what Siri is. To see how they responded to statements like, "I'm depressed."
"It breaks my heart to see you like that. Maybe the weather is affecting you."
"I'm very sorry. Maybe it would help to talk to someone about it."
As you can tell, results were mixed. Apple even updated Siri's response to one of the researchers' questions within days after the Stanford study came out. So big tech is paying attention to the role of AI for mental health. And so are therapists. Because they know, when people my age don't know what else to do, we reach for our phones. In Oakland, I'm Ajani Torres-Cedillo from Marketplace.
Ajani's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. This final note on the way out today, two items from the Trump administration that are worth a macroeconomic mention. First of all, the president of the United States told Bloomberg in an interview this morning he is considering breaking up the big banks. A Glass-Steagall Act for the 21st century is what the White House likes to call it. Bank stocks had a brief moment of agita and then regrouped. Also, he is considering raising the gasoline tax, currently 18.4 cents a gallon, if you're curious. Not, however, indexed for inflation, hasn't been raised since 1993. And that is all we got. The Dow off 27 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ up 43, 0.7%. The S&P 500 up 4 points, about a 10% or so. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.